Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the AIVA podcast brought to you by the New Mexico Wildlife Federation. This is Jesse Dubell. I'll be the host of today's show, and I'm joined by two really fantastic guests. These are individuals I've been working with for a significant length of time, people I have tremendous respect for, and individuals who work in the conservation space that provide a perspective very different than mine in some cases, which I think is really important because it helps to ensure that we're approaching conservation from all of the different angles.
The New Mexico Wildlife Federation presents the AIVA podcast.
First with us today is Kevin Bixby. Kevin is the executive director of Wildlife for All. Kevin, would you like to introduce yourself? Tell us how you got into this work, a little history about your career, and kick us off.
Well, hey, Jesse. Really glad to be on the show. And I've been working in wildlife conservation, wildlife advocacy, basically all my life, all my career, and I'm 65. I'll just go on record. I have a degree in biology from college, and I got a master's in natural resources policy. Came to New Mexico quite a few years ago and started something called the Southwest Environmental Center. And over the years, just sort of, we focused on a lot of different issues related to wildlife and public lands, but really started gravitating towards the wildlife end of things. And then last year, we made a transition to change our name to Wildlife for All and to focus on really the systemic issues of wildlife governance at the state level. You know, who gets to make the decisions? How are decisions made? You know, how are agencies funded? And so on. We came to realize over time that all of these individual specific issues that we were dealing with, like wildlife killing contests and trapping and et cetera, were really symptomatic of basically those questions of who makes decisions and how they're made. I'm really happy to be on the show and talk about these things and others.
Well, fantastic, Kevin. And you currently are based in Las Cruces, New Mexico, but your organization works across the nation. Is that right?
That's right. Wildlife for All is a national campaign to reform state wildlife management in every state to be more ecologically driven, to be more democratic, and to be more compassionate, really to reflect what we know about the importance of all species in ecosystems and to reflect public attitudes towards wildlife. And so, yeah, we have staff across the country. It's funny in this COVID time, we have five staff and I've only met one of them in person, but we meet every week at least once on Zoom. And so I know what they look like, but yeah, it's a national campaign though. And these are different times, aren't they?
They are. It's a matter of fact, we're recording this remotely, not so much because of COVID, but more because of the distance, the physical distance between us. But, you know, Kevin, you and I started working together over a decade ago, actually, I think, is when we first met each other, probably. And I think we've been on the different sides of certain issues. We've been on the same side of other issues. And one of the things I hope we're able to highlight as we move through the conversation today is how beneficial it is to have that dialogue and to build those relationships with people who approach wildlife management and from a different perspective because they have a different set of life experiences. And the reality is, and I really appreciate the name of your organization, Wildlife for All, because the reality is wildlife is a public trust resource. And you and I have actually had the conversation where the word resource sometimes you don't feel like is appropriate. But nonetheless, wildlife is not something that exists only to certain individuals. It's something that we collectively all have a responsibility to take care of. And so I'm sure we'll talk more about that as we move on, Kevin, but I'm really glad to have you here. Always a pleasure working with you. And also with us today is Andre Miller. Andre is the treasurer of the New Mexico Wildlife Federation. He serves on our board of directors. In addition to that, Andre's with Western Resource Advocates. So Andre, you want to talk a little bit about your history, your career, what you do for WRA, and anything else you think the audience might be interested in?
Yeah, thanks, Jesse. Thanks for having me. And hi, Kevin. I'm based in Santa Fe. I was born and raised in New Mexico, spent most of my life here, and I've been working at Western Resource Advocates in New Mexico on land conservation for the last few years now. I mostly focus on conservation finance and conservation funding. Recently, I've been spending a lot of time working on how the state of New Mexico can better leverage federal funding, both existing and new funding that has been passed in the last couple of years, and how the state can do a better job of getting some of that money on the ground towards conservation projects. So thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks, Andre. And I think your experience with conservation funding is going to be super valuable to this conversation, because really, I think that's one of the focal points I'd like to really discuss here is money, quite frankly. Conservation is not convenient, and conservation is also not cheap. You know, it takes a lot of money to conserve species. And as human population grows and development increases and urban sprawl increases, I think it's becoming ever more important to ensure that adequate resources are put towards conservation. So would one of you gentlemen like to discuss how conservation funding currently is structured in New Mexico? How do conservation dollars work at the state level in New Mexico?
I suppose I can take a shot at that, and Kevin, please jump in and add anything if I miss something. Well, you know, New Mexico is, you know, like some of its neighbors and unlike some of its neighbors, is very dependent on oil and gas revenue. And we have had huge swings in our state budget. And our state budget is the main source of funding for conservation in some cases. In other cases, like Game and Fish, it's the department's reliant on user fees and hunters and fishers. I guess state parks also has some sort of reliance on entrance fees and users, but the state has just seen huge swings in funding across administrations from the general fund. And again, that's somewhat of a dependence on oil and gas in our state budget. So we don't have too many dedicated financing mechanisms. And what I mean by that is a specific tax or a specific fee across our state that goes towards conservation funding. Other states have relied on these types of funding mechanisms. For example, in Colorado, Great Outdoors Colorado uses lottery revenues. Montana recently legalized marijuana, and they're going to use marijuana taxes for conservation broadly. So there are a number of ways that states have approached funding conservation beyond just appropriations and specific user fees.
Yeah, thanks, Andre. I know that in Missouri, so longtime listeners of this show will be familiar with the organization Driftwood Outdoors, which is the professional production agency who produces this particular podcast. But they're based out of Missouri. And in Missouri, there's a 1/8 of 1% sales tax. And that money goes to fund the Missouri Department of Conservation, it's called. And you mentioned, Andre, the New Mexico Department of Game and Fish, which is an enterprise agency, as you said. So it's funded by license dollars, the sale of hunting and fishing licenses, and then matching federal dollars that are provided by Pittman Robertson and Dingle Johnson. Those are excise taxes paid on firearms, ammunition, fishing equipment, and marine fuel. So for every dollar the New Mexico Department of Game and Fish generates, $3, they're eligible for $3 of matching funds from those federal pot of monies. At least that's my understanding. Does that sound accurate to you, Kevin?
Yeah, it does. You know, every state's different in terms of how its wildlife agency is funded. And New Mexico is sort of at the one extreme of the spectrum, Missouri being at the other extreme. New Mexico gets about 60%, the New Mexico Department of Game and Fish gets about 60% of its budget from the sale of hunting and fishing licenses, which is a pretty high dependency relative to other states. And as you mentioned, it gets most of the rest of its budget from those federal grants, Pittman Robertson, Dingle Johnson. Now, Missouri, on the other hand, because they passed that 1/8 of a percent sales tax dedicated to conservation, I think it was back in the 70s. It's the inversion of that structure. It gets most of its money from the sales tax, the Department of Conservation I'm talking about. So, and you said something earlier in the show, and that's a pretty radical concept, and that is that wildlife belongs to everybody, or it is a public trust. It doesn't actually belong to anybody, but everybody has benefits from it, and the government has a duty to protect it for everybody. And if you follow that logic, which I totally agree with, I believe wildlife is a public trust, and that we all benefit from wildlife. whether we hunt, whether we fish, whether we just go out and birdwatch, or whether we sit home, we still benefit from healthy ecosystems that wild animals are components of and contribute to the functioning of, that provide clean air, clean water, you know, nutrient recycling, pollination, all these other things that we benefit from. So if you accept the notion that wildlife is a public trust, like a public good, like libraries and schools and police departments, if you accept that notion, then it makes sense that the public should pay for it. And it shouldn't be incumbent on a particular user group like hunters and anglers or, you know, gun buyers at the federal level to pay for the protection and management and the maintenance of this public trust. I think it should be broadly that this financial support should be shared broadly for that goal.
Kevin, I agree with you 100%. And right now, as you know, I'm a pretty passionate hunter. Right now is what I refer to as application season, because the New Mexico Department of Game and Fish has a deadline. I believe this year it's March 16th at 5 p.m. I'd have to double check to be certain, but I think that's the deadline. So now is the time when I'm going through the Big Game Rules and Information booklet, and I'm looking through all of the data, and I'm checking last year's draw odds, and I'm trying to plan out my year and figuring out what hunts I'm going to apply for and all of that. And when it's all said and done, you add these hunts into your shopping cart on the online system. And at some point before March 16th at 5 p.m. or whatever the draw deadline is, you have to click that checkout button. And it's expensive. Although in New Mexico, we've not had a license fee increase since 2005. The bill passed in 2005, went into effect in the 2006 license year. So we haven't seen a license fee increase since 2005. Meanwhile, inflation is, you know, off the charts right now, more than I've ever seen in my life. But if you look at the price of a pickup truck in 2005 compared to a pickup truck now in 2022, it's drastically different. And what I would suggest that is that the current system, no matter how much hunters appreciate it, the current system is not sustainable for the average person, for the average family, especially if you have a couple of kids and you have a whole family who's going to hunt. You're not going to be able to afford to do it. The average family is not going to be able to afford to do it if the funding of the New Mexico Department of Game and Fish falls exclusively on the shoulders of the hunters and anglers of this state. Hunters and anglers are not going to be able to afford to participate in the not too distant future. So I completely appreciate and agree with your comments that we need to develop, we need to incorporate, we need to somehow adopt a much broader funding mechanism. So I'm curious if you or Andre have suggestions on what that might look like.
I'll take a stab at that and then let Andre chime in. You know, people talk about a backpack tax, you know, a tax on outdoor recreational equipment that would be dedicated to conservation. I personally am not in favor of that, because I think we should need to get away from this idea of a user group. And I actually disagree that outdoor recreationalists are users of wildlife. They're outdoors, but they're not necessarily watching wildlife, not necessarily going outdoors to see wildlife. You know, they're just out for a walk or a hike or to go, well, to go birding. They are going to see wildlife, but you know, they're not necessarily buying hiking shoes and backpacks in connection with enjoyment of wildlife. And like you said, wildlife is a public trust. Everybody benefits, and everybody should be involved in the financial support of making sure that public trust is here for future generations. So I really am not in favor of these ideas of a user tax, whether it's on guns or on backpacks. I support a broad-based funding mechanism. And I think the most equitable, but it's also one of the hardest sells politically, is income tax. Simply, you know, general operating funds that the state collects as part of income tax. And if your income tax structure is progressive, then that's a progressive way to pay for public goods like schools, like libraries, like police departments, and like wildlife. That's my personal view.
Yeah, I'd agree with much of that, Kevin. I also think there's fiscal reasons to try and diversify these revenue streams, where if you're solely dependent on hunters and anglers and they're the only source of funding for the department, there's a reliance there. Similarly, if you only tax backpackers, there'd be a particular reliance on that group. So I think that there's generally a tendency, looking broadly at taxing a particular group to pay for a particular good. You know, when you pay a tax at the gas pump, that money goes towards roads. And I think people try and connect those various fees to a particular service. But there is, again, benefits in diversifying those revenue sources and relying on multiple revenue sources. You know, again, I pointed to something like in Montana, marijuana taxes going towards conservation. You know, those are two very unrelated goods and services and taxes. So how can we look to those types of creative solutions to fund our state agencies for conservation?
Well, you know, Kevin, you and I worked really closely together leading up to the 2021 legislative session, and we worked on a bill that would have drastically changed the New Mexico Department of Game and Fish. It would have changed the name to the New Mexico Department of Wildlife Conservation. It would have also changed the scope of the department, would have provided the Game Commission with the ability to increase the department's authority to manage species that currently they don't have jurisdiction to manage. What's interesting to me about that is as the leader of an organization comprised primarily of hunters and anglers, I received a lot of criticism that this was an effort to remove game, the word game, from the department, and that was an anti-hunting movement, that I was trying to bring more people to the table and get more focus on species that are not hunted by our state wildlife agency, so that we were taking care of all species opposed to just those species targeted by hunters and anglers. And not too many episodes ago, we recorded a discussion on this very show with Richard Fagerlund, the bug man. I went down a lot to Las Cruces, and that episode, folks can find it. It's called From Bumblebees to Bison. And talking about the importance of ecosystem health to everybody, including hunters and anglers. Certainly hunters and anglers benefit from that. But I want to go back to the Missouri situation, because we talked about how that funding model is so unique across the country. But also worth noting is that, again, their state wildlife agency is called the Missouri Department of Conservation. There's no reference to hunting or angling. But interestingly, when you look at Missouri, their recruitment of hunters and anglers is off the charts compared to just about any other state in the country. So clearly we can change the system in New Mexico. We can change our state wildlife agency and do it in such a way that everybody benefits and it's not harmful to the hunting and angling traditions of New Mexico. I'm curious if you'd like to talk about that for a little bit.
Yeah, it's like so many things in our society, it's this issue's become pretty polarized, where if folks talk about changing the status quo in wildlife management, you know, whether it's making wildlife commissions more representative of the general public, whether it's finding different, more broad-based sources of funding for wildlife conservation, whether it's changing the law like you talked about. We worked very hard on that bill last year that would have simply given taken the handcuffs off our Department of Game and Fish to be able to be a protector of our full range of wildlife diversity in the state. Right now, the department, the commission and the department only have authority over about 60% of the vertebrate species in our state, and virtually none of the invertebrates. Now, if you're a fisherman, you know the importance of invertebrates. I mean, that's just very clear. It's a very direct connection between the health of your fish population and the health of your insect population. So, I mean, if, you know, we're the world has experienced a mass extinction crisis, you know, in New Mexico, throughout the United States, throughout the world. And in the United States, our system of wildlife conservation is set up. It gives the states the leading role in protecting wildlife. And yet here in New Mexico and in other states, we haven't given our wildlife managers the authority, the legal tools they need to protect that diversity in the face of climate change and all these other factors. So it's not about hunting or anti-hunting. I see a place for hunting and fishing forever. It's about just modernizing our system of wildlife conservation to match the progress that's been made in ecological understanding over the past 100 years when our, you know, game commission was created and game laws put in place, and also matching changing public attitudes. Fewer and fewer people are hunting, but hunting will always be part of wildlife conservation. We're not saying get rid of hunting. We're saying expand the focus, expand the funding support, and expand the, and make the whole system of making wildlife decisions more democratic. Yeah, it's unfortunate because some of these, frankly, a lot of hunting groups, the Sportsman's Alliance, the Congressional Sportsman's Foundation, the NRA, they always label any sort of suggestion of changing the status quo as being anti-hunting. Like, this is the camel's nose under the tent. And I'm a hunter myself. I put in for an Oryx tag every year. I never get one, but I put in for one. You know, I eat meat. I'm not opposed to hunting. I am not, my group is not anti-hunting, and yet my group is running a national campaign to change the status quo.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you saying that, Kevin. And when we talk about modernization, I think it's important for people to realize when the New Mexico Wildlife Federation was formed, we were formed as the New Mexico Game Protective Association, and that's because game populations were on the brink of extinction. I mean, we were in a situation where if there had been an Endangered Species Act in place at the turn of the century, just about every species on this continent would have been on the list. And it didn't take very long until the organization realized that really we need to be looking out for the future of all wildlife. And so the organization changed its name to the New Mexico Wildlife Federation. But when you look at the situation today, it's generally not the game species that are, you know, species of greatest conservation need. We don't have problems with our elk population. We don't have problems with most of the populations of species we hunt. Where we're seeing a great need to really work to recover species and keep them from being added to the endangered species list, we're seeing that on species that are generally not pursued by hunters and anglers, which is another really important reason that the department needs to be modernized, because when all funding comes from hunting and angling and matching dollars, there tends to be a priority to focus on the species that hunters and anglers are primarily interested in, and those are not the species that need the most help. So what's interesting, we talked about this bill that we worked together on to kind of reform the New Mexico Department of Game and Fish, or our state wildlife agency. Now we're anticipating the passage of the Recovering America's Wildlife Act. When that bill passes, I think the department absolutely has to undergo some serious changes. I just don't think that there's any way that the agency can maintain status quo when they see an annual budget change from $47 million a year to $84 million a year. It's going to require significant internal adjustments to be made within that state agency. So, Andre, I'm curious if you'd like to talk a little bit more about RAWA, what it is and what it means for New Mexico.
Yeah, it would be a game changer for the department. As you noted, it's something like, was it $9 million in state matching, brings in $28 million in federal funding. So just a truly unprecedented shift in funding for the department. I would note that it looks at the moment, as we're recording this, we're in the middle of the New Mexico legislative session, that it looks like legislators are going to be appropriating some of that match that's needed to bring in the federal funding, which would be great for the department. And again, it would get out of this dependence on this one revenue source for conservation funding. One example that I should have thought of before that I'd like to bring up now is, you know, the state of New Mexico has a gross receipts tax, and that tax funds a number of services. And one department that gets a small portion of that is New Mexico State Parks. So the state is not has, you can point to one example in the state of a general tax going to a state agency. I think it's something like $3 to $5 million a year, and it mostly goes towards maintenance projects at state parks. So anyway, it's not that idea is totally absent in our state. We just need to continue bringing in new revenues like that. And I guess, speaking of new revenues, RAWA is one piece of federal funding. The state has also seen a number of others, including the American Rescue Plan Act, which the state has begun appropriating in the special session at the end of 2021. And it looks like they're going to be doing more of that in this current session. There's also the Infrastructure Investment Jobs Act, which has passed, which will provide grants to states for a number of conservation purposes, including building wildlife crossings on highways, which I know is a priority of the department as they go through their wildlife corridors action planning process. And we could see more in the future. So there's a lot of new funding to be had. And I think it's imperative that organizations like the three of ours push the state to spend that money in ways that benefit conservation and benefit wildlife.
Thank you for that, Andre. And I really feel fortunate, based on your last comment, organizations like the three of ours, when you look at these three organizations, Western Resource Advocates, the New Mexico Wildlife Federation, and Wildlife for All, you're looking at a really diverse group. I mean, the three organizations represent a lot of diversity in this state, and I think it's powerful when diverse organizations work together to accomplish a common goal. That's something a lot of people are afraid of. You see a lot of hunters and anglers in particular get uneasy when they see diverse coalitions formed. But I like it, and I think it's necessary, and I'm very encouraged by the fact that we have such a great working relationship. So thank you for those comments, Andre.
Yeah, I would agree with you, Jesse. I do agree with you. I think New Mexico's a bit unusual and a bit of a leader, definitely a leader in among the states in the diversity of groups that are working, for the most part, agreeing with each other on what needs to happen with wildlife conservation. And that's not the, especially now that I'm working on a national campaign, I understand that that is not the case in many states. So, and I've said this before, I attribute a lot of that to the leadership of you, Jesse, and the New Mexico Wildlife Federation. It's been like this for a while. And we do have our disagreements. You know, we disagreed on the trapping bill, but we agreed on the killing contest bill. We agree on the need to modernize the department and to find new funding. So, you know, we have a lot that we agree with, and that's, I think that is very powerful. I just want to go back to one thing that Andre said about RAWA, the Recovering America's Wildlife Act. And this, again, underscores the need for legislation to give our Game Commission and our Department of Game and Fish full authority over wildlife in the state, because all this money that's going to be coming to all the states if RAWA passes is to be dedicated to the conservation of something called species of greatest conservation need, which are identified in state wildlife action plans. And without going too much into the weeds and the details, those are generally, as you said, Jesse, non-game species. But if a department lacks the authority to manage those species, it really can't add those species to the state wildlife action plan, the list of species of greatest conservation need, nor can it use RAWA funding directly to benefit those species. So again, we need to untie the hands of the commission and the department so it can use RAWA to its fullest potential.
I couldn't agree with you more, Kevin, and I commend you for all of the work that you did on Senate Bill 312. It's so unfortunate that we weren't able to get that across the finish line, because the proper course of events, or the proper chain of events, would have been to get that passed and then to pass RAWA. This way, our state wildlife agency would be in a better position to take full advantage of RAWA. Unfortunately, the fact that we weren't able to successfully pass that bill kind of puts things out of turn, if you will, in the order that things are getting passed. But one of the things that continues to be a challenge for me here at the Federation is that when we talk about the broadening the funding source, there's just so much concern about bringing people who are not hunters to the table, putting more chairs around the table for people who don't hunt, and this growing fear, or this continual fear, that that's going to have an adverse impact on the hunting and angling traditions of this state. And I simply don't think it's true. I think that those are unjustified concerns. I think as hunters, we need to do a really exceptional job of being stewards of the resource, being ethical, honoring fair chase principles, all of these things that make hunting more tolerable for folks who don't participate. You know, it makes hunting more acceptable for people who don't hunt. And so we need to continue to as hunters, and I'm talking to my audience here, but we need to continue to ensure that we are being really appropriate ambassadors for the activity, and that we're behaving in ways that are appropriate and ways that are not going to create opposition. You know, there's a huge movement in this country, and it's the R3 movement, right? It's to recruit new hunters, to reactivate people who used to hunt and no longer do, and to retain hunters so that once somebody gets into it, they stick around and they continue doing it. The reason R3 is so important is because of conservation funding, is because hunting funds conservation to a large extent. And we're going to get more into this in a minute, I think, Kevin, because there are definitely other contributing funding mechanisms across the country besides just hunting. And oftentimes hunters say, we fund conservation and we leave it as though we're the only source of dollars, which isn't necessarily true. But that's why R3 is so important. But as we work on R3 activities, as we work to introduce new people into these activities, we're simultaneously complaining about our draw odds. We're simultaneously complaining that we don't draw enough tags, that, you know, I haven't had an elk tag in X number of years, or as you just mentioned, Kevin, that you'd never draw an oryx tag. And I hope you do draw, because I'd love to accompany you on that hunt. Should you draw that tag, I'd love to go to help. But what I think is really often overlooked is the importance of normalizing hunting to those folks who are non-hunters. I mean, recruiting new hunters is great, and I'll never speak out against that. But equally important is making sure that the hunting community is doing a really good job of making hunting something that the non-hunting public doesn't look at with a negative eye, something that the non-hunting public looks at and appreciates and accepts and is willing to allow to continue. And if we do that, and if we do a really good job of that, then we shouldn't be afraid of inviting more people to the table to make the decisions regarding how we manage wildlife. And, you know, that's my soapbox speech here, but I really feel strongly about that, that the people who are afraid of inviting others are people who have, in many cases, done a poor job of representing what hunting is. Now they're afraid of someone who has a negative opinion of it showing up to help make decisions. But perhaps if we'd been more proactive, that those individuals would not have a negative perception of the activity to begin with.
Jesse, just a couple thoughts on bringing more folks to the table, so to speak. You know, just looking at the simple math here at Recovering America's Wildlife Act, looking at new funding through the Land and Water Conservation Fund, looking at these other restoration programs that are coming through the federal government, looking at Pittman-Robertson, Dingell Johnson, all of these require non-federal matching funds. I mean, state funds that will bring in these federal dollars. We're talking about more than tens of millions of dollars in state match needed for these. And I think it would be difficult, to say the least, to impose those additional revenue needs on hunters and anglers through increasing fees for that particular user group, that I think we need to bring in that money from somewhere else. So I don't think any hunter angler would say that we should not bring in those federal dollars and not put those dollars on the ground towards good projects that benefit wildlife habitat, but rather look for additional state match. And I think that it's time, or it's unavoidable, I suppose, to bring in that additional funding and those additional stakeholder groups.
I think you're spot on with that, Andre. I do think it's unavoidable. I also think we still need a license fee increase bill, and we need that bill to pass. We need to adjust license fees at least to keep up with the inflation that's occurred since 2005, when that last license fee increase passed that I mentioned earlier. I think when we do this, I think when we pass a new license fee increase bill, it's going to be a huge wake-up call to the hunting angling community, and I'm hoping that they'll see this hit to the pocketbook, which is what it's going to be. You can't go that many years without an adjustment and then not feel the effects of the adjustment. You know, in other states like Colorado, Andre, you might be more familiar with this. They have an index. They have their license fees tied to the consumer price index. So as the consumer price index changes, I think every other year license fees kind of automatically adjust. There might be a process where the Senate has to approve the adjustment, but it's kind of – they've essentially automated the system of license fee adjustments, which we've not done in New Mexico. So what we do here is we wait way too long and then have to see this huge increase that you feel – in a very painful way to your personal finances when that license fee adjustment goes into effect. But I think we're overdue for one. The Department of Game and Fish, hopefully someday soon, would be called the New Mexico Department of Wildlife Conservation, is dependent on a change. And hopefully when that change happens, the license buying public says, wait a second, this is getting a little out of hand. We need the rest of New Mexico to help us foot the bill to protect the wildlife that we all enjoy.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. In Colorado, they did those changes 2 years ago or something like that, and the increases year to year are pretty small, a couple percent. But again, there's this federal money available now that requires matching funding now, and we can't just rely on hunters and anglers to come up with those additional funds in the short term through these fees.
So, Andre, could you talk a little bit about some of the strategies that you've been working on to help find that money at the state level that could then be used as a match to bring federal dollars into the state?
Sure. Again, we're recording this in the middle of the legislative session. For the past few months, the governor has thrown her weight behind a general obligation bond. She's calling it the Land of Enchantment Bond. That would fund a number of state conservation programs, including the Department of Game and Fish directly. And I see that as beneficial for a couple of reasons. One, again, it gets towards these general revenue sources, getting revenue from the public the broad public generally. And it also is a long-term funding mechanism, meaning a general obligation bond. The state has, I believe it's 4 years to spend that money. So it gets away from the year-to-year fluctuations in annual budgets. So I see benefit to a funding mechanism like that. Separately, the legislature, it looks like they're going to approve a number of significant increases in general fund spending to some of these agencies, which just are pretty unprecedented. Some of it's federal money. Some of it's, again, general fund money from a bit of a surplus this year. And I'm pretty excited for those to go through because we're talking about tens of millions of dollars being appropriated this year to these programs, where in past years it's been, I don't know, it must be a tenfold increase or something like that just from the last couple of years.
Yeah, and thank you for all your hard work on that, Andre. I know you've really been working hard with the whole conservation coalition in New Mexico to build support for some of these really, really important tools during this short 30-day legislative session. And this podcast will actually publish. It'll be publicly available on March the 1st after the session will have ended. And hopefully one of the things that will have happened during the session is that the Department of Game and Fish will have been allocated the money they need to purchase the El Bar Ranch. I'm curious, Andre, if you'd like to talk a little bit about that project.
Yeah, this would expand the Marquez Wildlife Management Area. It would turn into the largest wildlife management area in the state. Forgive me, I forget the exact acreage number, but it would be again another game changer for the department and open up a lot more land that was previously closed to the public and open that up to hunters and the general public as well. I suppose they have to might need a recreational permit to access those lands, but put it in the public trust, which I think would be a great outcome. And I just note that at the moment while we're speaking, it looks like the legislature is going to appropriate the funds to complete that project. So that would be a big win.
Yeah, that'd be huge. And it's a very well documented migration corridor for elk and mule deer. You know, there's two sections to the El Bar Ranch. One is on the north end of the Marquez Wildlife Management Area. One's on the south end. The north end is unbelievable summer habitat. The south end is excellent wintering habitat. I think the total acquisition with both parcels would be 52,000 acres. And I don't know this for certain, Andre, but I think it would make the Marquez Wildlife Management Area the largest WMA in the entire country. Again, I don't know that for certain, but I haven't yet been able to find a larger one. And bringing this back to conservation funding, something I'd like to mention is that in 2011, Senator George Munoz helped to pass a bill. He sponsored a bill that did a number of different things. But one of the things it did is it made all hunting opportunity on the state wildlife management areas exclusive to New Mexico residents. So the Marquez, being the largest WMA in the state and perhaps the country, would provide tremendous hunting opportunity to the residents of the state. And as we talk about conservation funding, one thing I think is important to mention is that non-residents pay significantly more for their individual licenses than residents pay. So non-residents are a very important component to funding the New Mexico Department of Game and Fish, and that certainly can't be ignored. And we have to be appreciative of those non-residents who spend significant money to come into our state and enjoy the land of enchantment and enjoy the wildlife that's available here. But the State Wildlife Agency also has an obligation to the residents of this state who collectively, you know, own essentially, in air quotes, the wildlife that exists within the state. And so I get really encouraged when I see increased resident opportunity. And for folks listening, this is not a land grab. This is not government overreach. This is nothing like that. This is a willing seller. This is a person who owns a ranch, who wants to sell the ranch. And Game and Fish says, hey, we'd love to buy the ranch. We'd love to make it a wildlife management area and manage it exclusively for the benefit of wildlife. So it's not a, you know, situation where the government is utilizing eminent domain or anything like that. It's very much a willing seller, willing buyer situation. So my fingers are tightly crossed that we see this particular project come to fruition, and that in the next hunting season we have a lot more New Mexicans out enjoying our public lands on the Marquez Wildlife Management Area.
Yeah, just one other policy tool that I'd like to bring up, Jesse. You know, we've been talking about funding particular agencies for particular purposes, funding the Department of Game and Fish for game management and non-game habitat restoration, funding state parks, leveraging some of these federal dollars. One thing that I'd like to see New Mexico adopt eventually, the lawmakers to adopt, that is used in other states that is very successful, is having a single conservation grant program that can be utilized across agencies and between agencies for projects of conservation. You know, in Colorado, it's Great Outdoors Colorado, and it's its own independent agency that again grants money to other state agencies and to subdivisions of the state, cities, counties, for conservation projects. And this is one way to leverage the Land and Water Conservation Fund, but again, to complete projects on the ground and make sure that various agencies are talking with local governments, county governments, tribes, et cetera, and granting funding to these various state entities for conservation projects. And I think that would be a great direction for the state to go at one point.
Yeah, thanks, Andre. I agree with you completely. And doesn't Wyoming have something kind of similar to that? Or doesn't Wyoming have a trust fund that kind of serves that purpose in that state? Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, I believe that's right. A lot of states have various programs that have varying authorities. But you know, for example, in New Mexico, we do have what's called the Natural Heritage Conservation Act. And this program was created in 2010. It's been unfunded for the last decade and can, again, grant state funds to various entities for conservation projects. So I'd like to see that program revisited and some of the authorities in that program expanded and ultimately get a dedicated conservation financing mechanism to direct funding to a program like that, that all state agencies could draw funding from.
Yeah, thanks, Andre. And Kevin, talking more about conservation funding, there's a number of mechanisms in place that are mandatory for hunters and anglers. I know you and I have talked about that in the past. For example, if a person's going to hunt waterfowl, you're going to need a federal duck stamp. You know, and I think the federal duck stamp generates something like $81 million annually for wetlands conservation programs, things like that, to help U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service acquire and manage, you know, various habitats. Generally, those habitats are going to be national wildlife refuges, like Bosque del Apache in New Mexico is one example. At the state level, we have a $10 mandatory habitat stamp. That means anybody who's going to hunt or fish on federally managed public lands in the state is required to have that $10 habitat stamp. And that money generally goes to improving habitat by funding things like trick tanks, drinkers, cattle exclosures to keep cattle off of riparian areas, those kinds of things. A lot of thinning projects, some controlled burns. But those are mandatory. So you know, a hunter or angler doesn't have a choice but to participate. There are, though, some voluntary programs. The New Mexico Department of Game and Fish has one in particular called Share with Wildlife, that anybody who wants to just contribute financially to conservation can go on the department's website and make a donation to Share with Wildlife. And I'm curious if you would like to talk about ways that we could perhaps increase the amount of participation in some of the non-voluntary conservation funding programs, both from the hunting and angling community and from the community of folks who maybe don't participate in hunting and angling.
Okay. Well, you know, I said this before, my opinion on these voluntary, you know, funding sources is that they just don't work. They're just, I mean, hunters and anglers, they get something very tangible in return for that paying that fee. They get the opportunity to take a wild creature out of the wild and use it, you know, or not. They get pleasure from fishing for it and catch and release maybe, but there's the prospect of getting a tangible consumable good after paying it. Most of the Share with Wildlife goes to, well, it goes to some habitat projects. It also goes to research. And the tangible connection is just not there for most people. It's not, most people aren't going to be aware of it. And you can spend a lot of money trying to promote these programs. I don't think you'd, you know, it'd be a good return on, you know, on investment. You know, I just think that we would not ask, you know, it's like asking the, you know, that there used to be a bumper sticker, you know, should we ask, you know, the Navy to hold a bake sale to build an aircraft carrier? You know, it's just like, it's just not going to work. It's a public good and it costs money and people ought to pay for it. You know, if you have a government, the government ought to make sure that everybody's paying for it. I mean, you can ask people to voluntarily donate and some people always will. And, you know, maybe you give them a nice license plate. I just don't think these programs are very effective. You know, it's just the amount of money they raise is just not anywhere near the money that's needed. I mean, hunters and anglers, they pay these fees. You know, some of them have, you know, lofty conservation goals in mind. Others just do it so they don't go to jail if they get or to get a fine if they get caught. But they have to do it to participate in those activities. And I don't think we want to, if we made, you know, we do have entrance fees for national wildlife refuges. So the general public does pay a mandatory fee to go on and enjoy those places. But I don't think we want to go in the direction of erecting barriers for people to go into nature that are going to discourage people without money to do that. I mean, there's some balance that can be drawn there. But I think as a society, we want people to go out into nature. I think we're a better society for it. It's just like we want people to go to libraries and we want people to go to school. We don't want to discourage people from engaging in those activities because we're all better off if they do. That's my soapbox.
No, that's good, Kevin. That's actually fantastic. I'm really appreciative of that perspective. And I couldn't agree with you more as far as trying to eliminate financial barriers. This is something in New Mexico we see with the increasing privatization of our state wildlife where – you know, people like you and me who apply for a hunting tag and try to draw it oftentimes are disappointed because we don't draw the tag. Meanwhile, someone with the financial means is able to hunt every single year. All they have to do is pay the price, you know, pay the auction fee, and they can hunt New Mexico every single year if you have deep enough pockets. So I really appreciate you saying that. And we've continued to talk about wildlife as something that should be funded similar to a lot of other public infrastructure, right? We talk about roads or the military or schools or libraries. One thing that's interesting is even RAWA, even the Recovering America's Wildlife Act, is not actually taking tax dollars and putting it towards wildlife. You know, the Recovering America's Wildlife Act is funded primarily by penalties that are incurred on companies for environmental infractions or violations. So like the British Petroleum oil spill, for example, you know, they were fined billions of dollars, and it's those dollars that are funding Recovering America's Wildlife Act. So in this country, so far as I can tell, there really is no allocation of tax dollars, with the exception of the Missouri example we brought up a few times, that funds wildlife conservation, unless I'm missing something. Kevin, are you, or Andre, do either of you have familiarity with a program that actually takes tax dollars and funds conservation?
Yeah, I'll just say
it's
that.
It's hard to speak to all 50 states.
There are a handful of states that have followed that model. I think Arkansas is one, maybe Minnesota. I don't know off the top of my head. There aren't many, for sure. But I will say at the federal level, the general taxpaying public does fund conservation to a huge extent. You know, federal lands, there's more than 600 million acres of public federal lands, and those lands are extremely important for conservation, providing habitat for thousands of species. And the cost of maintaining and managing those lands is primarily borne by the general public through tax dollars. So there is a model at the federal level.
I think that's right. It's hard for me to think of too many specific examples beyond the states that I work in. You know, just another example of a kind of interesting experiment for conservation funding is coming out of our neighbors to the north in Colorado, where just last year they passed a bill that would change the online form that the public uses to register their car every year. And on that form, there will be a checkbox where they'll either have to check or uncheck a box that would impose a fee. I can't remember exactly how much it was. I think it was like $50 or something, but it would be an annual state park pass. So the idea was that they would increase participation in this voluntary program. Again, I understand, Kevin, the issues with voluntary programs, but it would greatly expand the number of people that are able to participate in that program that may not have otherwise. And I don't want to try and predict how successful it will be. We should know at the end of this year just how much additional money that program generated for Colorado State Parks, but an interesting model to consider.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up, Andre. You know, state parks continue to be an area in New Mexico that struggle when it comes to funding. Legislators like to create a lot of free days, right? There's all kinds of incentive to make all these free days to the state parks. And sometimes I feel like our Department of Energy, Minerals, and Natural Resources, where state parks is housed, is standing there like, well, wait a second, how are we supposed to pay for that? How are we supposed to maintain this facility? I was actually last weekend up in Eagle Nest Lake State Park, went up there to do some ice fishing, and it was negative 24 degrees. That was very frigid, but as beautiful of a place as it is, there's definitely some infrastructure needs that need to be addressed, you know. And I think in a perfect world, if we had the conservation funding models, Kevin, that you've talked about, I don't think we would be experiencing those issues. And Andre, you talked about the dependence in this state on oil and gas revenues. And it's really unfortunate when we are one of the largest oil and gas producing states in the world, really. I mean, the Permian Basin, I think, produces, if you looked at it on a global scale, it's towards the top of production outputs when it comes to oil and gas. Meanwhile, as a state, we don't have the money to pump the vault toilets at Elephant Butte Lake State Park. So that's should be alarming to people. People should look at that and say something's not right here.
No, you're totally right, Jesse. It's hard to look at a lot of our state agencies. Some of it is decreases in funding from the previous administration and the current administration just not keeping up. And as you noted, problems with inflation and a dollar appropriate to an agency, just doesn't go as far as it may have quite recently. So there's a significant need for funding our state agencies. And, you know, the governor's committed to increase in conservation through her 30 by 30 initiative. So hopefully we see continued leadership on that front.
Yeah, I sure hope we do, Andre. And I think we will. I remain very optimistic. I mean, some of the tools that are coming into place, you mentioned earlier, one, wildlife crossings. I think at the federal level, they just approved $350 million for new wildlife crossings. Folks in New Mexico might be familiar with the New Mexico State Wildlife Act Corridors Plan, the State Wildlife Corridors Action Plan, WCAP, which was recently introduced. It's a 718-page document, I think, that prioritizes 11 specific wildlife crossings where wildlife crosses highways. These are hot spots. These are places that would really benefit from an overpass, an underpass, strategic fencing, things like that. I recently read a statistic that in Colorado, the same number of deer are killed every single year on the highways and roadways of the state that the same number of deer killed on highways and roadways that are harvested by hunters. And so if you think about the amount of increased opportunity that would be there if you were able to prevent those wildlife vehicle collisions, it's pretty immense. But as we're coming up on the hour now, Kevin and Andre, I'd love to give you both the opportunity to provide some kind of closing thoughts, talk about anything that you're working on or anything that you've prioritized that you think should be part of this discussion that the audience should know about. Make a plug where folks can find you, how they can support your organizations and the important work you're doing, those kinds of things.
Sure. I guess things I'm excited about, again, I kind of mentioned this, but some of the new appropriations that hopefully we'll see as this legislative session comes to a close for some of our state's conservation programs. I'm excited to see how some of this federal funding plays out and how the state is able to leverage that. It will require additional actions from state lawmakers and state agencies to really pull that money into our state where it's desperately needed. So I am optimistic. Again, you can find my organization at Western Resource Advocates if you want to reach out and learn more, but I'd point folks to the Wildlife Federation as well and some of the great work that Jesse and his team are taking on.
And I'll say that, we're definitely in a time of change in New Mexico and other states. I think, from my vantage point, running a national campaign, we're trying to promote this change and focus it in a direction that'll make sure that we have the institutions and policies in New Mexico and everywhere, win the resources to protect wildlife and protect biodiversity in the face of climate change and the extinction crisis. So we have these existential threats that we need to deal with, but I also see movement. I see, wildlife agencies looking for new funding sources, both because of RAWA, and that's RAWA itself is encouraging, but also because, the number of hunters and anglers is either declining or plateauing in most states. And, you just can't keep funding wildlife conservation on the backs of a declining, number of people. So I think there's a lot of forces that are converging and that if we work together, we can make sure that we get, that we will have good outcomes. And one thing I want to mention, if I may, is that the New Mexico Department of Game and Fish commissioned a study looking at different funding options to match RAWA. And they, the consultant surveyed a whole bunch of New Mexicans, and the support for new sources of funding was pretty remarkable. It's pretty overwhelming. So I think New Mexicans are willing to, spend more money to protect our wildlife.
Hey, Kevin, I'm glad you brought that up. And I'm going to ask this question of both you and Andre, I think. We talked, Andre, about the fact that we're in the middle of the state legislative session currently, and we feel pretty confident that by the time this podcast airs, we'll have seen a budget pass that provides an appropriation of general fund money that the state can use as matching dollars to get the full $27 or $28 million that would be available to us from the Recovering America's Wildlife Act. But that's a this year fix, right? And this year we have a budget surplus that's unlike anything we've seen in recent years. I mean, it's just crazy right now with the oil and gas revenues. There's plenty of money available. But what we're excited about right now is something that's great for 2022, but doesn't provide any certainty or stability for providing the Department of Game and Fish with matching funds to take full advantage of RAWA in 2023. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right, Jesse. A couple thoughts. One is a dedicated financing mechanism would be ideal, but there is something to be said about getting lawmakers in the habit of doing the same appropriation year after year. And, you know, the people in the roundhouse are just people like you and I, and when they get in the habit of something, it's usually they can maintain that habit for a long time. So I guess what I'm trying to say is the first year appropriating funding like this is the hardest, and hopefully it gets easier from here, assuming there aren't some of the huge budget swings, which are, I guess, are probably inevitable. But just getting it this first time is a significant win in itself.
Yeah, I think you're right about it being a super significant win, Andre. And I don't, you know, you work a lot behind the scenes, as does Western Resource Advocates. Just from my observations, you're not out in the public face of some of these campaigns as often as some of the other conservation organizations. But the work you've done has been critically important to getting us to this place. But I do think it's really important that we, as a conservation coalition, if you will, address the fact that a year is going to come, and it could be next year, that oil and gas revenues are not strong like they are currently, and that the state is facing a huge budget deficit. And if that's the case, we could face some real challenges in coming up with the matching funds for RAWA. So hopefully we can get creative and try to find something that would provide certainty year after year, because if we get the RAWA money this first year, for example, again, the department budget goes from about $47 million a year to $84 million. That means the department's hiring biologists, more conservation officers. I mean, basically, the department's doubling in size across the board, as far as I can tell. And it would be tragic if that appropriation was not issued in a future year after the department had hired up all of these full-time positions, right?
Yeah, it's going to be huge, and it's going to be a huge change for the department. And there's a lot of work to be done to prepare for that money, get that money on the ground, hire staff, increase capacity, and, you know, create the outcomes that we want to see. So it's a change in funding. It's a change for lawmakers. It's a change for the department. And there will be some hiccups and some hurdles to overcome, but hopefully we can get there in the near future.
Any other thoughts on that, Kevin, or any other plans to work together leading up to the 2023 session to make some of these really important, much needed changes? I know here we are, February of 2022, and it seems a little bit premature to be talking about the 2023 legislative session, but those of us who get involved year after year after year realize that it's never too early to start.
Yeah, I think as soon as the session's over, and maybe waiting until the veto deadline, the deadline to sign or veto bills passes, that our groups should get together and go visit the governor and tell her, you know, this time around, we're looking for your support, and we should start early. Last time, and we got a late start. And I think we need to tell her in no uncertain terms that it's just unacceptable that we have three of the seven seats on our game commission, the body that makes wildlife policy in New Mexico. It barely has a quorum. Three of the seven seats are vacant. They need to be filled, and they need to be filled with competent, professional people. And then we need to talk about the legislation that didn't pass that would modernize our, you know, commission and game department. And then we need to figure out the funding situation. So, yeah, we've got work to do. And I think, you know, as soon as the session's over, let's get together and do it.
Fantastic. Well, on that note, gentlemen, thank you both so much for all of your time today and for all of the hard work that you put in day after day on behalf of our state's wildlife and all of the residents of the state who really enjoy and benefit from that wildlife out on the landscape. I can't thank you both enough for your friendship and also for your advocacy.
Thanks, Jesse. Appreciate being on the show.
Yeah, thanks, Jesse. Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks, Andre.
Thanks for listening to the Ahiva Podcast, produced by Driftwood Outdoors.